Hey, it's Francis Lam. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you ever want more info on anything you hear on our show, you can always find it at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, more on our guests, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about getting you good things to eat and make on weeknights. But right now, here's this week's podcast, hosted by Lynn Rosetta Casper.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rosetta Casper. Mira Fine and Daniel Klein, the filmmaker and chef duo, came up with an idea to travel the world documenting how food figures in people's lives all around the globe. And instead of heading for famous restaurant kitchens, they track down the people we rarely get a chance to meet, way off the beaten path. Well, 150 short films later, this James Beard award-winning duo are back at it again, going in depth for season 4. Now, they've married in the meantime, and now there's a little one in their world. The three of them spent the past summer in Colorado. Daniel Klein joins us. Daniel, it is so great to see you again.
So nice to be here.
So, season 4, set it up for us.
The concept came about of going and spending a season in a place. So a summer, a fall, a winter. And really diving in deep. So we reached out to tourism boards and various places that we were interested in visiting and promoted the concept of making 10 films that really looked at a place in a way that other shows and other series don't have the time to do. Mm-hmm. So we go and we get an Airbnb and we spend 2 months really looking at all of the different farmers, fishermen, foragers, different stories in a unique region. So we started off with Colorado. We're headed to Ireland and then Mexico. And in each place, we spend a summer, a fall, a spring.
So a couple of months in Colorado, what did you find?
We got 150 story ideas recommended to us, and we chose ones that were interesting to us. So, you know, there's great immigrant farming stories. We found beautiful wild food CSAs. Three stories in particular that were pretty fascinating were folks living out of an RV who fish or hunt all of their food. So they're in an RV parking lot, and they go out fishing every day. They freeze it. They smoke their fish. They preserve it. Then during the hunting season, they do the same thing. And so they go to the store to buy salt and flour and you know, some staples, some oil, things like that. And they did that because the partner, Kevin, was having serious health issues. And they just tried it first as an experiment to see, what if we cut out all conventional meat and only ate wild food? Mm-hmm. And he was on all these drugs. And within a year, he was off all the drugs. And living off of the food that he had harvested himself. There has to also be something to do with just kind of a way of life. They're retired and living in this RV, and he goes out fishing every day, you know, standing in the river on the Rio Grande, surrounded by mountains, casting a fly rod. Like, what could be more peaceful than that? So I'm sure there's a combination there.
So who else?
We spent a lot of our time in Durango in southern Colorado, which is a gorgeous little town. And just outside of the town, there's a place called Turtle Lake Refuge. And that spoke to us because we hadn't heard of anything like it before. It's a wild food CSA. So all of the different herbs and lamb's quarters and mushrooms and different things that grow in the wild, they pick those and put together a little box each week of a collection of not just the raw foods, but then they also prepare them for you a little bit, because who knows what to do with thistle root or mallow. You know, so they give you a recipe, and then they also, you know, make a cold chai tea from thistle root, and they make actual real marshmallows from mallow root.
So who is doing this? Is this a group of people or is it a couple?
This was started by a woman named Katrina Blair, who's kind of a, like maybe a type of goddess. She lives in a, you know, a tree house, literally a house that surrounds a growing tree. And it's a very magical place, and she lives with a number of other women. It's kind of surreal, magical land that they live on. I having a difficult time describing how it is, but you walk in and are kind of overwhelmed just by how they're living with nature. And it started by just her, you know, caring for this land that she had, and it has since grown in interest as people become interested in wild foods and in organic farming and in not using pesticides and so forth. And they don't call it a CSA, as in community-supported agriculture. For them, it's community-supported abundance.
Mm-hmm. Great shift in mindset. Is there someone else who comes to mind?
We met this lovely woman named Bessie White in Cortez, Colorado, and she's, I think, 83 years old. And started the Cortez Farmers Market. Her and actually her sister, who's 2 years older, they had some extra tomatoes and some extra zucchini and wanted to do something with it. They were farmers, and they just set up on the courthouse parking lot 43 years before. Without permits, they just kind of asked the town, you know, mayor, hey, can we sell some stuff here? And it just blossomed from there. And has only missed one farmer's market since. You know, she's the kind of woman who ages gracefully. She's like the ideal grandmother. And she made a strawberry rhubarb pie with rhubarb picked from her garden and strawberries that she had frozen earlier in the season. And just kind of told about what life was like in Cortez, Colorado, where they didn't, 30 years ago, they didn't have electricity. and just kind of had a way of showing that doing things yourself, making your own dough, making your own pie, was just something good in the world. And that we didn't, you know, need to go out to the store and buy everything, but that, you know, the old-fashioned way is pretty okay sometimes.
So she's at that farmer's market every week?
Every Saturday. She now makes 16 pies a week, sells them for $6 each. She's a delightful woman.
Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mira Fine and Daniel Klein are the partners behind the award-winning Perennial Plate. Now, to check out their films and learn more about their Series 4, head to our website. It's splendidtable.org. You may know this, but the British happen to take their gardening skills very seriously. As is said across the pond, doing wonders with the garden is very, very high praise. Now, Jacob McVicar happens to do wonders beyond wonders. She's said to be the most accomplished herb gardener in England, where she grows some 300 different ones. When Jekka talks herbs, we listen, especially when she's got so much to say about the herbs that are so easy to get right now. Jekka, good to have you back.
Lovely to hear you.
You know, I was on your website, and I was looking at sage. I had no idea that there were that many different kinds of sage.
Sage is salvia officinalis.
A medical herb. Okay.
Yes, another medical herb. And sage is wisdom. Salve means to heal. And so it is steeped in such huge history. The Chinese would barter you anything you wanted for a barrel of sage. Sage is considered one of the most healing herbs. Now, for you at home, if you've got sore throat or sore mouth or sore gums, it is absolutely fantastic as a mouthwash, wonderful as a gargle. 3 leaves into a cup, add boiled water, let it stand for 5 minutes, strain, let it cool down, gargle. And please don't worry if you swallow your gargle, because sage actually feeds the memory. I mean, it's another memory one. But sore gums, you've been to the dentist, you know, and you want to make your teeth pearly white. That's how the Romans cleaned their teeth. They actually rubbed leaves. Yeah, with sage. And children, when I have children around, you know, I teach them this and they think it's wonderful. And then you get things like Salvia elegans scarlet pineapple, and that's a pineapple-scented sage. And I don't know if you have over there in the USA things like a sweet candy called pineapple chunks.
No.
When you smell it, it's just like pineapple. How nature does it, I don't know. And it has scarlet flowers. I mean, whoa, you know, really makes you go, phew. And then there's a tangerine-scented sage. And there's a blackcurrant scented sage, and then there's broadleaf sage. And if you've ever been to Italy, one of the best dishes you can have is fresh pasta. You take it out the pan, and then you add to your hot pan some olive oil and some chopped sage, and you throw the pasta back in, then lob it onto your plate, put your parmesan on top. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, it's so simple. And here in the UK, you told me, I think last few times ago, that you use rosemary with pork. Here we use sage with pork. And you make meatloaf, don't you?
Yes.
And so you could chop sage into your meatloaf, and that would be really nice, with a little bit of nuts as well, with a bit of walnut. And what's interesting also about sage is it's got a natural preservative in it. And before fridges, refrigerators, were invented, people used to dig pits and they used to go salt, sage, meat. And that's how they preserved their meat.
Really?
Yeah, they used to dry it, yeah. And that's why it lands up in stuffing, historically.
Ah. Jacob, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Royal Horticultural Society named Jacob McVicar the Ambassador for Health and Well-Being through Gardening. Now, in addition to her nursery, Jacob's Herb Farm, she's author of The Complete Herb Book. And if you're in the mood to cook with sage, head to the website and check out my recipe for wine-braised carrots with fried sage. You know where to go. Splendidtable.org. Coming up, some great pantry ideas from Rachel Koo. A new yet very old pedigree salt, and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know how any original ideas for dinner seem to dry up on the way home from work? You're hungry, but what to make? A total blank. Now, here's where pantry smarts are essential, and Rachel Koo has them. Now, if you watch British TV, you probably know Rachel. She calls herself a food creative. And though she trained in classical French cooking, her style's all her own. She roams the world doing food events and filming her discoveries. Talk about an ideal person to lift us out of the same old, same old. Rachel's book, Rachel Koo's Kitchen Notebook, is a good place to begin. Splendid Table contributor Shauna Seaver spoke with Rachel from London.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You first burst onto the food scene several years ago with books about French cooking and your life in Paris, and you really became known for that. And this book feels so much more personal and more eclectic in terms of the ingredients and the flavors that you're working with. Tell us what inspired this new book.
Yeah, so for my new cookbook, I really wanted to share, you know, my notebook. So the idea came from the fact that I travel around the world with this little notebook and I scribble things, I stick random things in, I do little drawings, and it's very eclectic in terms of flavors and tastes and recipes and inspiration. It's just a little flavor of what I've experienced in the last couple of years, and also flavors from my childhood because, you know, my mum's Austrian, my dad's Chinese Malaysian. I grew up in the UK, but I also lived in Germany. Then I lived in Paris for 8 years. So I have this really kind of United Nations eclectic food background. So it's a real hodgepodge of, you know, foods and flavors.
But you do use all of these great flavors to spice up the everyday, quite literally. And what I would love to hear about is your process of recording notes and ideas for recipes as you travel. So, for instance, when you visit a new place, do you have a specific approach for culinary exploring, or do you just sort of leave it open-ended?
Sometimes it's just about getting lost wherever you go, or, you know, just wandering down a little street. I always have to go to a supermarket. Like, I was in Estonia and I went to the supermarket and I was like, oh, this is a nice turquoise colored box. I'm going to buy it. And then I went home to my friend's place who I was staying at, and I said, oh, I bought this. And he said, you bought a box of salt. I'm like, oh, okay.
So, well, you never know. I think it could be the most amazing salt you've ever had.
Yes,
you just don't know.
Exactly. So I think it's a good way just to discover what the locals eat to head to the supermarket or the market.
That's a great tip. You know, even if people travel right here within the States, you can learn so much regionally by going to the Piggly Wiggly or the Publix, because there are things that you can kind of bring home and literally bring those flavors into your own kitchen, which I think is something a lot of us could really use tips on to liven up our everyday cooking. So if we're talking about building a more global pantry, what are some tips to do that? You know, things that we can use every day that are a little bit different from what we might normally use.
So one of the places I went to when I was researching the cookbook was Istanbul in Turkey. And that was really inspirational in terms of flavors, very eye-opening. And they use a spice called sumac, which has this kind of a little bit sour, sweet, very fragrant flavor. I use it in my lamb kebabs. They're really simple minced lamb kebabs. You just blend it into the mince. You could also use it on grilled fish or meat. You know, if you're doing a barbecue, just a bit of olive oil, mix it in and just brush it on. There are many ways you could use the sumac. You could even blend it into a little bit of a salad dressing, drizzle on. You can be very playful with sumac. When I went to Barcelona, in Spain, they have this beautiful paprika, and you get in these lovely tins. And sometimes I'm a sucker for packaging. So I just buy the tins, like I'm buying random boxes of salt in Estonia. So, you know, they have this lovely sweet paprika, and that paprika is great on, I make this spice rub for my trout. Really simple, and you just put it on the trout, you grill the trout, you've got this lovely, delicate fish which really goes with that sweet paprika flavor, nice green salad on the side, and you've got a simple dinner, nothing fancy, but just a little bit different than your regular, oh, I'm just going to grill the trout with some olive oil and salt. And there's one thing I have from my Malaysian heritage. I always go and have like wonton mee, which is wonton dumplings with noodles with a special sauce when I'm in Malaysia. And when you go to a good place, they do pickled chilies with them. And it's like sweet, sour, and spicy at the same time. So you've got all these crazy sensations going on in your mouth. Now, those kind of chilies, it's not easy to find them outside Malaysia, but they're kind of the thing that you could easily replicate at home. And those pickled chilies, you can make, you can keep in your fridge for like months. It's easy. You can add it to pizzas. You can add it to stews. You can, I mean, I eat it out the jar. I put it on cheese on toast. It's a great way to add that kind of zing and that kind of ooh to your dish when it's lacking something.
I want to talk about your flavor combinations, because that's one of the things that you do so well. And you know, perfect example, you do a shepherdless pie. It's sort of a vegetarian shepherd's pie where you take lentils instead of meat and it has a polenta topping. You do a strawberry and cream layer cake with black pepper, which is a really interesting twist. And I just wanted to know if you could tell us some tips for thinking about flavors in a different way. Like, you have a really unique perspective on how you combine flavors.
Well, because I have such a mixed heritage, I've always kind of mixed things up, and I'm never afraid of trying new things. One thing I experienced in Istanbul was, you know, it's Asia meets Europe, and they combine butter with soya sauce. And I love butter and I love soya sauce, but I never thought of putting them together. And boy, it's an amazing combination. I do this hot butter and soy sauce mackerel, and it's like that saltiness from the soy sauce with that creamy kind of rich flavor of the butter, and it's just divine. And you're like, just, okay, if you think something might work, give it a go. You know, there's nothing to lose. Like, I do a smoked haddock hash, and I had, the recipe came from, I have random ingredients in my fridge, like cornichon, creme fraiche, and some salmon fish eggs. I'm like, oh, well, I've got potatoes. Let's see what I could make. And actually those cornichons, which are little like crunchy gherkins, the acidity works so well with that salty fish eggs and the creamy creme fraiche. And I was like, oh, why did I do it beforehand? You know, it was like when you discover like things like that, oh my goodness, it's like a revelation.
It's happy accidents in the kitchen. Those are the best ones.
Exactly.
And I mean, butter and soy sauce. Everyone has butter and soy sauce. I mean, I think I'm very hungry right now. I'm going to have to go home and try that out for myself. It sounds amazing. Well, thank you so much, Rachel. It was great having a chat with you.
Thank you.
Rachel Koo is author of Rachel Koo's Kitchen Notebook. Contributor Shauna Seaver is a food writer whose latest book is Real Sweet. Now, you can find Rachel's recipes for cauliflower cheeseburgers and potato churros with red pepper sauce on the website, splendidtable.org. Journalist and food writer Ronnie Lundy has spent the past 30 years trekking across Appalachia, capturing both its history and the challenging landscape. Now, this is Ronnie's home ground. She was born in the small town of Corbin, Kentucky, and she's dedicated her career to chronicling what she describes as the people of the hillbilly diaspora. Splendid Table contributor Von Diaz talked to Ronnie about her latest book, Vittles, and one of the most interesting culinary histories of the area, salt.
Ronnie, it's so great to have you here.
I am so delighted to be here.
So, Ronnie, you cover a lot of ground in this book, but I was really struck by your chapter on salt. How did there come to be salt in this region?
It's really pretty fascinating. It goes back to the creation of what we call the Appalachian Mountains, which were originally a part of a chain in what is now Morocco. And that was on the continent Pangaea. And there were huge upheavals and continental shifts and splitting. And so the mountains that we know today, which at this time were much taller and more dramatic, broke away and sailed across the ocean and became the eastern part of the United States. And in the midst of all these same kinds of upheavals of tectonic plates shifting, etc., an ocean, the Iapetus Ocean, manages to slam in underneath of these mountains. And that is where the salt originates from. It begins to work its way up through the rock and through the dirt, etc., until it comes up and forms these salt licks in the mountains themselves.
Yeah, and there's a legend around how salt was discovered, right?
Right, right. So Mary Ingalls Draper, who was one of the earliest settlers in the 1750s, was captured from her settlement in Southwest Virginia by the Shawnees. And she and some other captives were taken up the Kanawha River Valley to where the salt licks there were. And they were forced to harvest the salt, which was very tedious. You had to do it by hand. It required heavy fires. It was the work you gave to slaves. And they proceeded on. They may have even gotten as far as the Big Bone Lick in Kentucky before Mary, in November, managed to escape. And she walked back some 500 miles, just existing on berries and what she could find, and got back to Eggleston Springs, right outside of where she had been captured. And she told the European settlers about these salt licks, and that is where the salt industry begins.
And other industries grew up around the salt, right?
Yeah. To extract the salt, you need heavy, hot fires. And so they discovered, oh, hey, look, here are all these incredible hardwoods. We can sell this as fuel. We can also sell it as building material. And then they started using the coal because they didn't want to burn up their cash crop of lumber. That is a large part of how coal mining becomes part of the essence of West Virginia, Southwest Virginia, and Eastern Kentucky. And then the third part is that the same things that deliver the salt deliver other chemicals. So if you ride between Ashland, Kentucky, and Huntington, Charleston, and along certain areas of that area, what you see now are chemical industries that actually grew out of salt. But it also has a big impact on our foodways. That's a part of the story that's pretty interesting, too.
Yeah, I mean, salt and Southern food, I feel like, go hand in hand. I mean, it can be quite salty food. What are some salty foods from this region that folks might recognize?
Well, of course, country ham. And there's always that wonderful moment when somebody takes their first bite of a country ham and their mouth puckers and they wonder what they've gotten into. But there are a lot of foods that are specific to the Mountain South, partly because we had winter and wanted to preserve foods. So we ferment a lot of foods with salt. Green beans are called sour beans. Corn, we put into crocks and salt down, and of course sauerkraut. All those ferment and become very good healthy foods. We just seem to really like the taste of salt. My Aunt Johnny, when she would cut the tart little sour June apples that she dried, we would sit on the porch swing and she would cut them and she would salt her pieces of apple before she ate it. She always told me that that made it sweeter. I'm not sure I was convinced, but it was interesting. And as kids, we would put peanuts in our Cokes, of course. And my cousin David, one of his favorite snacks was to take Red Hots and put them on a saltine cracker. So there was I don't know, we're kind of salty people, you know, our humor is a little salty too.
So, Ronnie, I know from reading your book that the salt industry almost collapsed after the Civil War. What's going on in the salt industry today?
Well, there's a fascinating thing that's happening in the Kanawha Valley. One of the longest lasting businesses there belonged to the Dickinson family, and they continued longer than the other salt producers. They actually continued into the 20th century. They were producing industrial salt. And two of the heirs of that property there, Nancy Payne Bruins and her brother Louis Payne, a couple of years ago realized that they could harvest salt for culinary purposes. And they began harvesting the salt again, not in this massive, destructive industrial way, but pumping it up in a much more gentle way and pumping it into solar greenhouses where they evaporate it. And JQD salt has become one of the premium culinary salts. People like Sean Brock and Travis Milton and Shelley Cooper, chefs all around the area, Ian Bowden, are using this particular salt because of its remarkably clean taste, and it's local. It's pretty exciting.
Ronnie, thanks so much for being here. It's been great talking to you.
It's been wonderful talking to you, Vaughn. Thanks for having me.
Ronnie Lundy is author of Vittles. Vaughn Diaz is a writer and radio producer. Now, Ronnie left us with a recipe for ginger bean chow chow, a delicious Appalachian quick pickle. And you can find it, along with so much more, at splendidtable.org. Sonoma County in California is famous for its Pinot Noir and Cabernet grapes. Its wines draw international acclaim. Interestingly, though, the grape is not one of the original crops in this part of Northern California. Every year, locals celebrate the season of a much-beloved apple, the Gravenstein. And this storied fruit has become threatened by the boom of viticulture. Producer Jenny Cecil Moore brings us the story.
In the spring, if you drove all the country roads up here, all you saw was trees in bloom, you know, just beautiful as far as the eye could see. I mean, it was just gorgeous.
That's Paula Shatkin. She moved to the Northern California town of Sebastopol in the late 1990s. She's seen huge changes in this town, once a thriving apple-based economy with orchards of Gravensteins.
I have pictures, actually, of murdered apple orchards. You know, you go by this orchard that you've been driving by forever, and all you see is stumps and the whole trees lying on the ground. And then, at some point soon thereafter, you see, as far as the eye could see, you can see baby grapevines, you know?
Northern California has been synonymous with wine country for several decades now. But that doesn't mean that locals are ready to watch their apple heritage disappear.
When I moved up here, there was a fever pitch process going on up here where apple orchards were being chopped down and made into vineyards. And people were starting to really wake up to it. And I went to an early slow food meeting and said, "Can we do something about that?" And everybody said, "Well, why don't you?" And so that was the beginning.
Shatkin set to work to gain recognition for the Gravenstein. The slow food movement she joined works to educate people about eating local foods when they're in season. At their headquarters in Italy, the organization decides whether a food should be listed as endangered.
Foods that the Slow Food Foundation for Biodiversity adopts need to have cultural significance as well as being good, clean, and fair. Historically, this has been an apple-growing area and an apple-packing area. And during World War II, all the processors were very busy here drying apples to send to the soldiers in Europe. See, here it says the Gravenstein originated in Denmark.
The apple's origins are disputed, but it likely came from northern or central Europe. Historians agree that it was brought to California by the Russians in the early 1800s. Looking at old photos and advertisements, listening to stories, all helped to prove the apple's cultural significance.
I got pictures of all the parades and the adults here who grew up picking apples in the summer, and it's always been a big part of Sebastopol.
The work was worth it. A slow food presidium was established for the Gravenstein. That's the official name for a community group including farmers working to protect an endangered food. There are close to 500 presidia in the world and only 4 in the U.S. Having the presidia designation is good press for the Gravenstein, but it's still an uphill battle when land values are so high.
Nobody can afford to buy land anymore for apple trees. So it has to be people who already have land. And unfortunately, we're still losing apple acreage. They can get so much more money per acre for grapes.
Some local farmers are behind the effort to save the Gravenstein and doing what they can to keep orchards producing apples.
We have Gravenstein Highway, Apple Blossom Elementary. I mean, the whole area is kind of has a lot of remnants of the old apple culture that was so important here. Although maybe more accurately now it would be Pinot Noir Highway or Grape Blossom Elementary.
That's Hunter Wade. He's a farmer at Devoto Orchards.
So we're in western Sonoma County, and as you drive out here west, you're getting closer to the coast. We're about 3 miles west of Sebastopol, about 12 miles east of the Pacific Ocean as the crow flies.
Wade works in partnership with his wife, Jolie Devoto Wade. Her family started planting heirloom apples, flowers, and greens in the 1970s. Now the couple produces hard cider with Gravensteins.
I love the Gravenstein. It's my favorite apple to eat, and it's a great apple for making hard cider, too. When you bite into it, you get a big, great zing of acid and
wow.
A really nice, juicy sweetness that goes with it. It's a really balanced apple, and it's not too tart that kids don't like it, and it's tart enough that tart apple lovers like Macintosh apple lovers love it.
Wade says cider isn't new. People are just coming back to it.
Cider is really, it's kind of having a renaissance. In America's founding days, that was the drink that everyone, alcoholic drink of choice for everyone. People weren't really planting grain fields or hop fields, they were planting apples. And as people moved west, planting apples was also a way to claim land.
Wade says people have started making craft cider, just like they did with beer. Looking for different flavor profiles and textures, cider producers are being creative.
The cider market, 80% of it is millennials from between 20 and 39. They're very adventurous. They want to try new things. They want to have new experiences. The majority of the market are craft beer drinkers, which are very used to trying totally different products. They're not usually just stuck in one thing.
Cider is getting another boost from the gluten-free movement. Since many people are avoiding gluten, most beers are off the list. But cider is gluten-free. Making cider with the Gravenstein is a way to connect old and new.
So I think that exposing the Gravenstein to a whole new generation of people and getting it into their mouth, perhaps not by biting into it, but by drinking it, hopefully is going to make a lot of people connected to it. They love the story of the Gravenstein, and they see the reason why it's important to keep it in our heritage.
This apple is feeling the love. In an era of changing tastes and trends, the Gravenstein has staying power.
Jenny Cecil Moore is a Seattle radio producer whose work explores culture, art, food, and history. She's currently covering the stories of endangered foods in the United States. Well, with apple season in full swing, check out our guide selecting the right apple for your cooking and baking projects. It's on the website, along with a whole bunch of pretty fantastic apple recipes, including Ruth Reichel's Apple Crisp. Check it all out at splendidtable.org. Coming up, my favorite part of the show, your calls and interesting cocktails from our friends at America's Test Kitchen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to turn to your calls. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and you can call us 800-537-5252. Laura from Stanford, California has called us. Laura, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, first of all, thank you so much for taking my question.
You are more than welcome.
So I've been working on campus here at the university for about a year now, and during the spring and summer, I've noticed that I've been almost quite literally surrounded by lavender at times. Ooh. And I've heard a few shows where you've given suggestions for what to do with it, so I have some ideas, but more I'm wondering how I can collect it. Do I want the buds or the flowers? And there's also, I know that I've noticed there are quite a few variations, and I was wondering if you know if there's like a best one to use.
Now, I can't tell you the name of the best one to use, but
that's okay.
You have to
describe it. That would probably do.
Well, I love the kind that smells not so much sweet as very clean and very, very fresh. But what you should choose is what appeals to you most. So you're saying the Stanford campus has a lot of different lavenders growing.
Yeah, there's certain areas, especially around the Lucille Packard Hospital and in the building where I work, that there's just like these huge patches of it.
It's interesting it's near a hospital because lavender is famous for being very calming.
Well, maybe that's why it's around the med school.
So yeah,
need to calm down a little.
Yeah, considering the pressure they're under. You can use it dried, but you can use it fresh. And the buds or the flowers. The leaves even are going to have a lovely scent. Now, one thing you can do, which you may have heard of already, is you can take some lavender flowers or the leaves and put them in the sugar bowl, and you'll get lavender sugar. So anything that you use that with is going to have a lavender scent to it or an undertone. So,
okay.
You know, and the other thing is that lavender and a lot of others like rose and you know, other scents or flowers, rather, that are safe to use in food, anything creamy, it just mm-hmm. takes to it, you know, like a duck to water. So if you whip cream and first you let the cream sit in the refrigerator overnight with lavender flowers in it, a fair amount of them, and then strain it and then whip it, you'll get this lovely backdrop of the lavender. If you want to do a stirred custard, you know, which is usually just eggs and milk or half and half or cream and some sugar, a little vanilla, because vanilla and lavender work really well together, and then the lavender, and you cook that. You could even make a baked custard with that, but the idea is that you'd strain the lavender out after you let it sit.
Okay, great.
The other thing is lavender works really beautifully with citrus flavors, especially lemon and orange. Also, lavender, where you infuse a bit of it in a mild vinegar, like a rice wine vinegar, mm-hmm. and then you sprinkle that over sliced peaches or nectarines that are deliciously sweet and ripe. It is fabulous. A little bit of black pepper. And if you want, a little sugar. And you've got a really interesting salad. It's just delicious. So think about also, you could do a sugar syrup with lavender, where you mm-hmm. do one part sugar to a half part water. You do, let's say if you have a cup of sugar and a half a cup of water, you maybe want maybe 4 tablespoons of lavender flowers. And you warm that until the sugar has dissolved and you let it sit. And then you strain it and you have lavender syrup.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
And imagine that over ice with a squeeze of lemon and a little bit of gin, or maybe a little more gin. But it would be a great cooler. Maybe, you know, maybe some seltzer water in there, too. So you're going to have a lot of fun with all that lavender.
Oh, definitely. I'm looking forward to it.
But, you know, make sure they don't mind if you pick it.
I will definitely check. But there seems to be quite a bit. So I imagine if I pick a little bit here and there, they won't notice it.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, don't demolish one bush. Just pick
here and there. No.
Hey, Laura, thanks
I'll
for calling.
I'll trim it back for them. Thank you so much for all the great ideas.
You are welcome. Good to talk to you. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
We've got Betty calling from Republic, Washington. Betty, welcome.
Thank you.
Where is Republic?
It's on the dry side of Washington State, about 6 hours east of Seattle, up in the mountains next to the Canadian border.
Oh, that sounds like gorgeous country.
It is.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, my problem is too much coriander.
Oh.
We have a huge garden, and this spring I let a corner of it get carried away with itself. I had all of these volunteer coriander and dill plants, and I just thought, oh, we'll let them go.
Yeah.
Well, now I've got, I don't know, maybe 60 cilantro plants that have gone to seed. And there's only so much you can grind and give to friends.
That's a good point. But you can freeze it.
Yes.
Now, wait a minute. Are you talking about the heads with the seeds or the leaves?
The heads with the seeds.
Okay. Oh, golly, that could be fabulous. Grind them up. And, you know, that with a little bit of lemon or lime and a little bit of Thai or Vietnamese fish sauce and a little bit of sugar and garlic. Oh, it's the most wonderful dipping sauce. Marinate anything in it. Just put it on the table and let people spoon it over things. It's just delicious.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah. My husband makes a really nice Thai table sauce, and that sounds like a real nice addition to that.
I think it would be. It really would be. The other thing that's really wonderful to do with it, if you have any tomatillos around, is crush up the tomatillos in a food processor with the seeds, and again, lime, and this time, chili.
Oh,
and then
nice.
Use that as a dipping sauce for things like a stick of cream cheese.
Oh,
something
my.
Creamy and very fresh. This is an echo of something I had in Mexico City. It's so simple. It's a green tomatillo sauce, but you'd be doing it with the heads of the coriander instead of the leaves, and I think it would just be incredible. And they just brought it in a mortar and pestle to the table with these sticks. This was a fresh cheese, but it was pretty firm, and cream cheese works well. And they just cut them into sticks and surrounded the mortar with it, and it was just delicious. But again, it's just like the other sauce. You can do almost anything with it, and it will be delicious.
It sounds wonderful.
And by the way, instead of tomatillo, obviously it could be tomato.
And boy, do I have a lot of tomatoes.
Betty, good talking to you.
You too.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Every week, we turn to our friends at America's Test Kitchen for some hands-on cooking advice. This week, our managing producer, Sally Swift, checks in with Dan Souza. He's executive editor at America's Test Kitchen, and he's going to give us a little lesson in science and cocktails.
Hey, Dan, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So in full disclosure, I'm going to tell everyone, we were talking about what to do with you for some segments, and you brought up the idea of milk punch, which I was just grossed out by, and you are here to defend the idea of milk punch. So let's go.
I am. Okay, so the important thing to understand is there's two kinds of milk punch, really. There's one that's very popular in New Orleans, and it's creamy. It's actually got milk in the finished cocktail. But the kind that I want to talk about is called clarified milk punch, and it's really, really cool. It may be a little gross at one point in the making of it, but the end product is amazing. It's actually a really old technique. It dates back to the 1700s. And what you're essentially doing is adding a dairy product, usually milk. It can be half and half. It can be lots of different types of dairy to a pre-made punch. So it's got a lot of brandy in it, lemon, sugar. And when that milk hits the acidic and alcoholic liquid, it actually curdles, much like when you're making ricotta. And when that happens, it's kind of interesting. Those proteins, as they coagulate, they grab onto all kinds of stuff that's suspended in the drink. And a lot of those things mess with the clarity of the drink. So most cocktails are pretty cloudy. This grabs all of that and it settles into this raft. And if you strain that off, what you're left with is a crystal clear, really gorgeous cocktail And while the recipe itself is really old, the oldest published recipe is from the early 1700s. And David Wondrich's really lovely book called Punch, he has a recipe for it, Mary Rocket's Milk Punch. It's actually becoming quite popular to do this in bars again. And you see people getting really creative, making punches with all kinds of different flavors and even different methods of clarifying with milk. So they're adding it hot, they're adding it cold, using half and half, using non-dairy creamers and that sort of thing.
Huh. Okay, now, so the milk is essentially used as a clarifier, right? It's absorbing things, essentially, and then it's strained off. Are you doing this, like, is this a per serving drink, or are you doing a big batch of the mix, the punch mix?
Well, no, so that's one of the really cool things here is it actually preserves the beverage. So you do this in a relatively large batch. We have some recipes on cookscience.com that produce basically a quart of cocktail, and you can keep it in your fridge for months and months. When Charles Dickens died, they actually found bottles of milk punch in his cellar, and they don't know how old they were, but they were fine. Because what's really interesting is when you strip out a lot of the volatile compounds that you find in lemons, especially in citrus, you actually stabilize it a lot more. So if it's refrigerated, it can last for a long time. So a big boon to bars is they're able to make a big batch of milk punch ahead of time, and then it's super easy to serve. You know, sometimes just poured over an ice cube, sometimes it's just poured straight up into a nice glass, and you have this beautiful clarity so you can see right through it. It has a little hint of color from whatever it was made with, but it kind of belies like what you actually end up tasting. It doesn't seem like it would have that much flavor.
Huh, I'm kind of dying to taste it now. You've turned me around. And what kind of booze do you use in your recipe?
So we have three recipes up on the site that use a mix of them. Brandy is a really common base, and so is rum. A lot of classic punches were made with both of those. But one of my favorite ones is a black tea port milk punch. So it's got brewed black tea, port. It's also got some rum in there, and it's inky dark before you clarify it, and then you add the milk to it. You clarify it, you strain it out, and it looks like a blush rosé wine. Like, it's absolutely gorgeous, and you would have no idea that that's where it came from. One of the other interesting things about milk punch is the texture you get out of it is really rich and silky. And the reason is when the milk curdles, you're only curdling one kind of protein, casein proteins. And that's what happens when you're making cheese as well. What's left behind are whey proteins. You've heard of curds and whey. So the whey proteins are left behind, and they add a lot of body to it. So body is, you know, that rich thickness that we get in a wine that, you know, has aged for a long time. So it has a lot more body than you'd expect. So it's this clear liquid, and you go to sip it, and you're just kind of wowed by how much flavor and richness you get out of it.
Wow, okay, I want to try it. So is this British in origin? Punches always sound so British to me. Is that where it comes from?
Yep, so the British were the first to really kind of put punch on the map, but it became very popular in colonial America. And David Wondrich's book, Punch, is a great treatise on just the history of punch in general. So it's a really old technique in that way. And then milk punch wasn't a huge deal. I mean, you'd see it in a few recipes, and then it just died out for about 150 years. And it wasn't until really modern bartenders and kind of the mixology era came in that we really started to see it again. And now you can find it, you know, in a lot of bars, and they're doing just crazy stuff with it. So maybe they're using tequila and pineapple, and, you know, there's certain bars that'll just rotate out a new milk punch on offer all the time. And they're really fun to try.
Boy, I am sold. You did it.
All right, good. You're on the milk punch train.
Hey, Dan, thank you.
Thanks, Allie.
Dan Souza is executive editor at America's Test Kitchen. You can find a couple of recipes for milk punch at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Chef Yotam Ottolenghi, who said, "The difference between a bland tomato and a great one is immense, much like the difference between a standard sliced white bread and a crusty, aromatic sourdough." Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our associate digital producer is Chip Walton, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a good week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.